Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Barul Segal, an editor at the Book Review. Sam Tannenhaus is away. This week, a conversation with poet and former soldier Kevin Powers about his debut novel about the Iraq War, The Yellowbirds.
For me, I almost felt that I had to just sort of, you know, work through my own demons, such as they were, before I was able to really get any kind of clarity on what I wanted to say.
The prize-winning journalist and author Matt Taibbi discusses his review of Subversives, Seth Rosenfeld's expose of FBI surveillance of Berkeley during the 60s.
The lesson of this book to me is that the tendency of people who have power is to exercise it.
And of course, we have Greg Coles with Bestseller News. On our cover this week, Benjamin Percy reviews The Yellowbirds, a new novel that he compares to Leslie Marmon's Silco's Ceremony, Brian Turner's Phantom Noise, and Tim O'Brien's classic The Things They Carried. We're talking to Kevin Powers. Hi, Kevin.
Thank you for calling. I really appreciate it.
So, Kevin, this is your first book, and you know, you've trained as a poet, but this also draws a little bit on your own time in Iraq?
It does. I mean, particularly the kind of The emotional life of being a soldier, a very young person in this extraordinarily difficult situation, and also the kind of difficult readjustment period that follows, which I was able to, in a way, draw on my own kind of interior life reflections on that for the book.
So the book, it isn't a memoir, but are there elements you pulled from your own experience in Iraq? You know, both you and your protagonist were extraordinarily young when you enlisted. You know, you're both from Virginia. I was wondering if there were other sorts of details or characteristics.
So the specific kind of events of the narrative are all invented, but I did identify very strongly with his kind of interior life. The emotions that he feels, the sense of confusion. Those are all things that I felt or experienced to one degree or another, probably not as intensely as he does, but it felt very true to my own experience. But again, the specific things that happen to him, the things that he does, of course, those are invented.
After you served, you know, you got your MFA in poetry, right? And there's such a tradition of soldier poets. I'm thinking of Hart Crane, Rupert Brooke, Owens, Sassoon, and Spender, to say nothing of the novelists, Mailer and Vonnegut. Is this a tradition that mattered to you, or one that you drew on while you were writing this book, or something you wanted to resist its influence?
No, I mean, it's certainly not something that I thought very much about until I started writing specifically about the war. I mean, I'd been writing since I was a teenager, but it felt like sort of two kind of divergent paths that just kind of happened to come together in this strange way. But, and of course, all of those people that you mentioned were very influential to me, particularly after I got back and I was trying to find my own voice. But no, I didn't really feel like it was anything that I needed to resist or consider, primarily because, you know, I started out with no real idea that anything would happen with the book other than the fact that I had questions that I felt compelled to think about.
What kind of questions?
One of the primary ones is a sort of a larger question of what does it mean to try to be good and fail? You know, are we kind of the sum total of the things that we've done? Do our decisions that we make every day allow for some new kind of path for the future? Those kinds of things. And obviously, they related directly to my experience in Iraq and coming home, but also just sort of larger curiosity about kind of how to approach being a person in the world.
So readers, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about craft, because I think readers will notice from the first sentence that you're doing something very different in this book, and something that, I mean, if it isn't taboo, it's certainly become unfashionable when we're writing about war. I mean, since Hemingway, I guess, like, there's been this aversion to lyrical writing about suffering. Generally, you know, blunt, spare sentences seem to be the rule.
Right.
But you have this, like, these sinuous sentences, these pastoral scenes. And I was wondering, is this style something that you thought much about, or is it something that emerged more organically as you were writing about this material and writing about your experiences?
Well, I mean, I think that is in part a kind of feature of, you know, the kind of writing that seems to come naturally to me. But also, you know, I do believe there's an element of that where, you know, the rhythms of language, the kind of sonic features of language can match the kind of rhythms of our lives, the rhythms of our emotional states. And because with this narrator and also, you know, in my own experience, I'm trying to kind of sift through this constant state of awe that he's experiencing, right? I think awe is one of the, you know, it goes back to the romantics and everything. I mean, it's more complex than just sort of, for me anyway, I was trying to do more than just make beautiful sentences. I was trying to make sentences that reflected that sort of perpetual state of awe that he's in, the strangeness of his focus, the kind of the sort of obsessive way that he's trying to locate himself in space. And for me, I don't know if it's kind of a feature of where I'm from or who I am or what, but I mean, I think the landscape, the kind of the atmospherics can be kind of fundamental to that experience.
I mean, I wonder, do you think this has anything to do with being, I mean, you're from Virginia, being a Southern writer? I mean, I think it was Sally Mann who said that Southern artists have an appetite for beauty and sentimentality that would be lethal for any other kind of American artist.
I don't know for sure, but I know that that there are writers that I love that I think, you know, for say, you know, Lacombe Angel, like Thomas Wolfe, I know that's not the, you know, the most kind of critically popular book from that time period nowadays. But for me, I just remember the first time I read it, that it, yeah, I mean, it did, it actually did something to me emotionally, mentally. I felt like something was happening with the language that I had never experienced before. So I am kind of attracted to that aspect of it. And I think it's something that's more present. I mean, set aside kind of the Southern writers of prose. I mean, it's something, it's a key feature of poetry, probably no matter where you are. So there's that too. So I guess I'm in danger on both ends. I don't know.
Can you tell us a little bit about your main character, Bartle? Who is he? Where did he come from?
You know, there's this idea of kind of being ordinary that he fixates on in the book. And I think he understands that that was something that he was trying to escape, the sort of ordinary feature of being, you know, an American kind of at the edge of suburbia, nothing distinct whatsoever about his experience. Kind of, I think one of the reasons that he joined the military was an effort to escape that. But then it becomes something that he absolutely longs for when he discovers that he is now kind of isolated in this not unique experience, but certainly an experience that very few people understand. So there's this pull, this kind of longing, nostalgia even, for what he remembers of that kind of ordinary, very average life that he once had. And he can't find it again. And that's one of the incredibly difficult things that he's dealing with.
You know, there's such a push right now to get former soldiers to write, and this idea that it might be cathartic, that it might be healing, that somehow the isolation returning soldiers feel can be sort of bridged or sort of reconciled by writing either fiction or memoir. Is that something you felt to be true at all in your case?
You know, there certainly was an element of that. For me, I almost felt that I had to sort of, you know, work through my own demons, such as they were, before I was able to really get any kind of clarity on what I wanted to say. But, you know, I also had the great privilege to volunteer with a veterans hospital and help with a kind of a poetry workshop for veterans. So, you know, I've seen firsthand the kind of changes that can happen when somebody does connect with a piece of writing in a way that they've never experienced. And I think it is one way that people can sort of break out of that isolation. So yeah, I mean, I absolutely believe it's a worthy thing to be doing.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Oh yeah, thank you.
That's Kevin Powers, whose novel The Yellowbirds is reviewed on the cover this week of the Book Review. We're joined now by Matt Taibbi, the prize-winning journalist and author of such books as Griftopia and The Great Derangement. So Matt, this book is a product of, Subversives is the product of some 30 years of research, five freedom of information lawsuits, and I think Rosenfeld finally unearthed more than 300,000 pages of declassified documents, all about this surveillance at Berkeley during the free speech movement. What was at stake during the free speech movement? Why was the FBI so interested?
Well, I think a lot of this began in the mind of J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm. Dark mind that was,
the
too.
Dark mind who had during the Palmer raids in the 20s, had a lot of experiences with what he believed were subversive communist movements, and that deeply affected him for the rest of his life. And he, I think for the rest of his life, was seeing devils everywhere, and
right.
he really believed sincerely that there was a radical attempt to take over the country by foreign communist powers. But he saw it in places where it didn't exist.
Right.
And he was always in his career, I think, prompted to focus the energy of law enforcement in places where he felt a personal insult.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that insult emanating quite strongly from the University of California system,
mm-hmm.
which had done an essay question about the dangers of a police force like the FBI. And that was really what set off this long relationship.
It was one essay question.
That was really what did it, I think, more than anything else. That and the fact that Ronald Reagan, ended up becoming governor of California. But I think that it was really this essay question that triggered this feeling in Hoover that there was something rotten in the UC system.
Mm-hmm. And the FBI seemed to fixate specifically on Mario Savio, a young activist. What about him so attracted Hoover's ire and interest?
I think Savio just represented everything that Hoover hated about counterculture. You know, he was an intellectual. He wore a sweater. You know, he wasn't the clean cut,
right.
you know, militaristic young man that Hoover thought that everybody should be.
Right.
Savio was brave.
Uh-huh.
He was unimpressed with the grandiosity of the American police state. And it was, I think, it was Savio's insight that that American law enforcement wasn't as strong as perhaps it thought it was, that really started the free speech movement, that really started the protest movement. It was really his recognition that all we had to do was stand up and say no, and that the other side was really that weak intellectually. I think that was part of what Hoover was reacting to, is that Savio had that insight.
One point you make in your review so well is that how so many of these decisions had very personal roots.
Right.
Be Hoover sort of taking something as a personal affront, or Reagan, as you point out,
right.
developing this very cozy, questionable relationship with the FBI. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. Reagan obviously had a long history of anti-communism that really began in earnest when he was still an actor. He was the president of the Screen Actors Guild, and he interacted quite strongly with the HUAC, you know, the House on American Affairs Committee.
Mm-hmm.
But what comes out in this book, which I thought was really, really interesting, was that Reagan's decision to start cooperating more intensely with the FBI and with that committee really coincided with the slowing of his own acting career and the advancement of his wife's acting career, Jane Wyman, who was in movies like The Lost Weekend.
That's right.
She had gotten an Academy Award nomination, and it was at that precise moment where she was going up and he was kind of slowing down that he started becoming more and more convinced of this communist menace.
Now, I suppose there might be a temptation to sort of look at a book like this and to dismiss it as this kind of embarrassing historical episode and look at it as a closed chapter. Even the word subversive seems so quaint
right.
now. Is this the case? I mean, is it just, are there more checks on the FBI now? Is there anything to keep this from happening? Because, you know, it went beyond just surveilling students, right?
Right.
They tried to get the president fired. They did get Mario Savio fired from his job.
They interfered in the careers of thousands of people,
right.
in an extraordinarily casual way, which should be shocking and terrifying to people. And I don't think it's a closed chapter at all. I think if anything, the fact that electronic surveillance has got to be so much easier now than it
That's
was really back then. So many people live on the internet, and the tools that modern day law enforcement must have to investigate people must be so much more advanced than they were back then, when they literally had to do break-ins to find out the kind of information you can get with the click of a button now. I think this history should give people on both sides of the aisle a lot of pause, not just people in the Occupy movement, but maybe Tea Partiers too, because I think the lesson of this book to me is that the tendency of people who have power is to exercise it. You know, whether they're allowed to or not, whether they will always find a justification for investigating people, for turning over that rock that they're not supposed to turn over, and they'll always find a personal justification for it somewhere. The tools we know exist now for them to do that, and that I think is what should be really scary for people.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you.
That was Matt Taibbi, who reviews Subversives by Seth Rosenfeld in this week's issue. We're joined now by Greg Coles with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
How are you, Parle?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
So what's new this week?
Well, on the nonfiction side of things, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to count down.
Okay.
Usually I start from the top, but I'm going to do it Casey Kasem American Top 40 style here. New on the list at number 12, Nate Silver, who runs the 538 blog that appears at the New York Times website, has a book called The Signal and the Noise, looking at how predictions work and don't work, and how you tune out various noise to arrive at what actually is salient when you're looking at weather forecasts or the stock market or politics, anything where you're trying to predict the future. New at number 10 on the nonfiction list is a book called Listening In. It's by Ted Widmer. It's not actually by Ted Widmer, because it's transcripts of JFK's secret White House recordings, but they have been selected and edited by Ted Widmer. That book comes with a 2.5-hour audio CD.
Oh, wow.
So that you can actually hear JFK talking in the White House. People think that Nixon was the first, and in fact, he wasn't. Kennedy was also fascinated by technology and set up some secret tape recordings so that he could look back. New at number 9, a book called Into the Fire by a Marine named Dakota Meyer and his co-writer Bing West. New at number 7, the baseball manager Tony La Russa, who led the St. Louis Cardinals to the World Series in 2011, has a book out called One Last Strike about that season. New at number 6, the political commentator Ann Coulter has a book out about racial politics.
Oh, dear.
Called Mugged, which gives you the tenor of that book. New at number 2 this week, the highest ranking new title on the list, is Neil Young's memoir. I hesitate to call it a memoir. It's called Waging Heavy Peace. Its subtitle is A Hippie Dream. He wrote this without a ghostwriter. I hesitate to call it a memoir. It's more like an extended blog, almost. It's just kind of what's on Neil Young's mind as he sits down to write.
And what is on his mind?
It's pretty meandering stream of consciousness stuff. He does talk about his music career, his days with Buffalo Springfield and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and his solo career. He gives you all the highlights, but not in any kind of linear order. And he also just goes off on tangents to talk about the cars that he used to have. He complains about the quality of MP3s.
I have relatives like this.
Yeah. So it's actually kind of great. And it's great that he did it without a ghostwriter. And it's just like sitting down for a stoned conversation with Neil Young.
Uncut.
Yeah. Over on the fiction side of things, there are only three new titles. Down at number 11, there's a book called Founders by a Christian survivalist named James Wesley Rawls. At number 10, the writer J.R. Ward has a new book out called Rapture. And all the way at number one, new on the list this week, the first adult novel by J.K. Rowling, The Casual Vacancy.
Oh, and what are people saying about this?
Nothing nice, actually. Oh, no. Some people are. I should say Time Magazine, Lev Grossman, gave it a very favorable review there. Mm-hmm. Some other outlets have given it favorable reviews. But for the most part, people are very disappointed. They think it's dull. It doesn't live up to the magic of the Harry Potter series mm-hmm. that J.K. Rowling wrote. There's also been controversy about The Casual Vacancy, as there was with the Harry Potter series. You may remember that occasionally some fringe Christian groups would protest.
Witchcraft and
yes, all exactly. Yeah. All that witchcraft. It's Satanism. It's, you know, kids shouldn't believe in magic. Yeah. They should believe in Christ's rebirth.
Instead of Quidditch.
Yes. Yeah. So there would be occasional protests. Now there is a small group of Sikhs in India who are protesting about the portrayal. Protesting is maybe too strong a word, but complaining about the portrayal of a Sikh character in the book. There's a Sikh family in the small English village mm-hmm. where The Casual Vacancy takes place. And one of the two teenage girls in that family has some prominent facial hair. There's a tradition mm-hmm. among Sikhs, kind of a more orthodox strain of Sikh tradition, says that the body is holy, a gift from God, and it calls for not cutting your hair, trimming your hair, mm-hmm. facial hair, mm-hmm. body hair, and anywhere, and men mm-hmm. or women both. Mm-hmm. And so you will occasionally see some women with prominent facial hair, mm-hmm. and the character in the book has that, and is described at one point, in the words of another character who's clearly kind of a villainous, bullying type character who picks on her mercilessly mm-hmm. for this physical trait. He calls her a hairy man woman. He says she is mustachioed yet large mammaried.
And but he's clearly bullying her.
It's not J.K. Rowling
describing her.
That's right. Okay. It's clearly in the point of view of a bad guy in the book.
Right.
Apparently, a Sikh group in New Delhi, India, has been receiving some complaints from various Sikhs saying this is derogatory. And they have put the publisher on notice. They've said, we're going to sit down and read the book carefully. If mm-hmm. we find that it is, in fact, derogatory to the Sikh community, then mm-hmm. we are going to try to enact a ban in India and make sure that nobody in India can read it.
Reviews aren't enough. They're going to...
The timing actually is pretty interesting mm-hmm. because a week before the book came out, there was a Sikh woman with prominent facial hair. She's a student at Ohio State University.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Who was standing in line, you know, at a coffee shop mm-hmm. or an ATM or something like that. And a stranger took her picture and mm-hmm. posted it on the social networking site Reddit, mm-hmm. where people can post photos. With kind of a snide caption, I don't know what to conclude from this, or you know, it was something along those lines.
It was tagged under funny or something, right?
Yes, exactly. He was clearly making fun of her, and she responded to him on Reddit and explained the Sikh tradition and said, you know, when I'm dead and gone, nobody's going to care what I looked like. They're only going to care what my character was and how I did. The original poster actually apologized to her and to Sikhs, and she has since weighed in on the J.K. Rowling thing in the Guardian newspaper in London and said, I can't take offense at this.
Right.
People have described me the same way, and all that matters is the quality of your character.
Right. Thanks so much, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pearl.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.